It's the Florida BB Koran edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week we have listener mail, atheist bust, the reality check, resident bodies, and global hysteria. Now let's start episode 109.
Welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Dawn, your political science philosopher. So, Ethan, I signed up and I think I'm part of the election. I'm a polling clerk, maybe.
Congratulations.
What are you?
I will vote in the upcoming elections.
Which I think is very important, even though we have a horrible, counterproductive, doesn't really work form of democratic system. We should always look back at all the people in the Middle East, around the world, who are trying to kill other people just for the right to sit back on their asses and not vote like we do.
It's a wonderful system.
Well, you know, got to be proud where you can.
Exactly. Well, we got a great show today. We're going to be discussing all sorts of interesting things, including an email that we got in response to last week's episode. We were talking about Blasphemy Day, Draw Muhammad Day. I think we got our days mixed up a little bit, so a helpful listener wrote in to let us know about the differences. So from Aaron, and Aaron wrote, Draw Muhammad Day, which he abbreviates as DMD, and Blasphemy Day are two different days. Blasphemy Day is on September 30th, which is the same day that the Muhammad cartoons were published in the Danish newspaper. And that day basically is just to celebrate blasphemy. Whatever blasphemy you want to do, if you want to blaspheme about the Greek gods, you may go ahead and do so. Draw Muhammad Day is on May 20th, and that is about the decision by Viacom to censor an episode of South Park back in 2010. And its stated aim is to promote free speech and show radical Muslims that people and the developed world will not be intimidated by censorship. And so that's why people are encouraged to go around, draw pictures of Muhammad, because, you know, South Park was censored because they had a picture of Muhammad. And people put up on their Facebook status, you know, a hand-drawn stick figure of Muhammad and such, and a number of groups around, Lower Mainland and Canada and the United States drew pictures of Muhammad on their campus, which provoked a fair bit of controversy. I know in some cases you had people going around crossing out writing, this is Muhammad Ali, and stuff like that. So interesting little bit of facts there.
It's good that he pointed that out. I mean, in the odd sort of way, Draw Muhammad Day could follow on Blasphemy Day because it is blasphemous to Muslims. And I think the context of what we were discussing wasn't so much the date, it was a particular action and whether that was relevant for our particular culture as opposed to someone in Pakistan who might do a Draw Muhammad on Blasphemy Day.
Yeah, there's nothing that really prevents you from blaspheming against Islam on Blasphemy Day. I think Draw Muhammad Day was more of a direct, you know, kind of challenge, I think, to not just sort of radical Islam, but also sort of people who are advocating for censorship in general. And it was also kind of, I think, spurred on a bit by the fact that, you know, South Park had this sort of cultural attitude of screw you, we'll do whatever we want type attitude, which I think is what sort of caught on with Draw Muhammad Day.
True. And then, of course, someone had pointed out to me that, I mean, you know, why weren't people protesting Viacom and doing something against Viacom? Because they were the ones who actually made the decision to sort of, well, if you want to put it this way, knuckle under to the pressure.
Mm-hmm. And the funny thing is, too, South Park in the past had actually had Mohammed as a character on one of their episodes.
Yeah.
And they didn't cave in, well, supposedly they didn't cave in to Tom Cruise and the Scientologists when they did the Scientology episode, although that's something of a conspiracy theory, I suppose.
Yeah.
And they've had a history of making fun of Mormonism and pretty much every other religion too. So
they were Charlie were in fair dinkum, right? I mean, they were going for everybody, and it was wasn't like they were. South Park could be claimed as being sort of singling out Muslims and doing a racist way, which is sort of what we talked about some of the issues with Draw Muhammad Day. So they were doing it fairly, and it was just fortunately, Blasphemy Day is still alive, and as long as we focus on our own local form of religious domination, which I don't know what it is for you, it's obviously the...
I really hate the Greek gods.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm just so sick of Zeus being shoved in my face every time, I go outside. It's always,
I always wondered why you hated Saturn Day. Now it makes so much sense.
Yes, I despise that.
Although I think technically it's Roman, but we won't split here.
Well, yeah. But speaking of getting out there with a message, the famous atheist bus ads that came to Canada a couple of years ago, but noticeably were absent in BC, have made their return.
Woo-hoo.
And we will see atheist bus ads in Kamloops and Kelowna, and apparently Victoria as well. And we actually have an interview with Lauren Price, who is the branch leader of CFI Okanagan, and he's going to tell us a bit about the campaign that's launching in Kamloops and Kelowna.
Is he going to explain to us that on these buses it says that if you're a Christian, you're stupid and jump off a bridge, or is the atheist bus message slightly different?
Well, you know what? I could explain it, but the interview will do that for us. So stay tuned for that. Joining us now is the branch leader of CFI Okanagan, Lauren Price. Lauren, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ethan.
So the news is that the atheist bus ads are at last coming to BC in Kelowna and Kamloops. Tell us a bit about the ads. What do they say and when will they run?
Well, they say it's a typical ad. There probably is no God, so stop worrying and enjoy life. They are going to be put on the buses between the 11th and the 16th of April. We haven't gotten an exact date yet, but it's going to be in that time frame.
Okay. And tell us a bit about the background on getting these ads. When did the plan begin, and what have been some of the obstacles that you had to go through to get the ads?
Well, it kind of started in November of last year, and we started raising money at that time. We expected to get it going in January. That never really happened. The advertising company in charge of this, they were kind of dragging their feet. They were very hesitant about this whole thing, making us jump through hoops and et cetera, have lots of a bit of red tape. And, they're finally up and going now. It's been a slower process than we wanted. But, I mean, in the end, we're just glad these ads are going to be running.
And what do you hope the ads will achieve?
Well, I'm hoping, number one, that it is going to give the membership in CFI some inspiration. That's important for me, keeping morale high, etc. Number two, give us a bigger membership, and number three, get some dialogue in the community.
And what's your take on the numbers of free thinkers in Kelowna and Kamloops? What would you say is the percentage of atheists and skeptics up there?
Well, I believe the official statistic is something like, I don't remember off the top of my head, like 30%, I believe, of atheists. However, As far as actual free-thinking skeptics go, yeah, we're kind of few and far between. Maybe people don't accept the existence of God, but they maybe accept astrology, for example. It can be a little frustrating at times.
So this ad campaign will also give you a chance to let other atheists know that you guys exist and perhaps encourage them to come to events and be more active in the community.
Yes, exactly.
Excellent. What has the feedback been so far? Has it been positive or negative, or what's your take on it so far?
Mostly it has been positive. You know, the media has actually been pretty good. I mean, there was one exception. There is Pastor Tim Schroeder from the Trinity Baptist Church. And he wasn't, you know, less than enthused on it.
What did he have to say about the ads?
This is his quote. "There is a tendency to be disrespectful to advertise against one's personal beliefs in the pluralistic age in which we live. I'm a bit surprised that this is taking place, especially on city-owned buses. Someone had to approve this."
And what do you think about his claims that it's disrespectful?
Well, actually, after that went up, I have actually been emailing back and forth with him. And, you know, he does actually seem like a fairly decent guy. I can't say anything bad about him in that way. But I don't think they're, like, one point I did make to him in an email to him that this is not meant to be anti-theist. It's meant to be pro-atheist. It's maybe they would have a hard time differentiating between the two, but it's basically saying, you know, we're atheist and we're proud, you know.
Right. And why is bus ads the method of choice for this ad campaign?
It seems to get out there. I mean, it's certainly not unaffordable for a group on a budget, for one thing, and it's caught on in other places, and you know, it seems to work in other places, so why not here?
Oh, very good. I did notice that BC Transit has said that they will pull the ads if any vandalism happens to them. Now, this seems like it's punishing your group for being the victim of vandalization. What do you think about that?
Yes, that is ridiculous. I can't say anything else. That it's just utterly silly and ridiculous. I mean, yeah.
That's pretty much my sentiment as well. Well, Lauren, thank you for joining us on Radio Freethinker. Keep up the great work in Kelowna and Kamloops, and let us know how the campaign goes.
I certainly will. Thank you, Ethan.
Why, sometimes I'd like to take a peppermint and a switchblade and a Cadillac and throw it all in a fire.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
Radio for crazy people and the elderly. Oh, yeah. Situation.
Become a friend of CITR and receive great discounts at businesses around Vancouver.
Your Friends of CITR card will get you discounts on Main Street at Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear,
Woo Vintage,
The Kiss Store, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, Red Cat Records, The Regional Assembly of Text, RX Comics, Temple of the Modern Girl,
Flaming Angels Boutique,
and The Wallflower Modern Diner.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus, or visit us online at citr.ca.
We're back on Radio Free Thinker, so our thanks to Lauren for that interview, and all the best luck to the Atheist Bus campaign in Kelowna and Kamloops. Well, switching gears a little bit, we have an election coming up, don't we, Don?
We do. Actually, we got an email request from Janice, who was saying, you know, you keep talking about this political skepticism thing, and maybe you should actually do something, since we have an election. And you know what? You're right. We should do just a little bit of something, and we'll see how this goes on.
Bare minimum, really. I mean,
and we're anticipating, or we're hoping for a lot of feedback on this particular issue, because these are sort of set up as open-ended issues, but it's kind of based on the whole reality check idea. This is about public financing of political campaigns. The Conservative government's reiterated a threat, and now it's a campaign pledge, to abolish the per-voter subsidy for parties that they get to participate in the democratic process. Now, to begin with, we should understand there's actually three ways that the government financially supports parties. First, there is this per-vote subsidy that amounts to roughly $2 per voter per year that ensures that parties have sufficient funds to allow them to engage in political process and organize between elections. This accounts for, depending on the party, anywhere up to 55% for the Green Party. The NDP strokes in about 25% along with the Liberals, and the Conservatives get about 24%, a little more than that, percent of their funding from this. Now, a second form of financing is reimbursement of expense campaigns. This accounts for about 50% for the Conservatives, 60% roughly for the NDP and Liberal parties, and the Green only about 40%. So that's part of it. Now, lastly, in the largest portion for some of the parties is the political contribution tax deduction. This is where 75% of my tax donation to a party is reimbursed by the government as a tax credit. Now, this is where some of the numbers become quite different. Conservatives get roughly 25% of their donations through political campaigns, the NDP about 12%, and the Green Party about 16%. Notably, the worst of all this was the Bloc, which only gets about 7%, so not a lot of people donating in Quebec, but the party still does well there. The per-voter subsidy ensures that that the government subsidy is given out in a proportional manner to the party's support in the country. If the support was based upon campaign donations, as Harper supporters hope, then this becomes quite distorted. In the last election cycle, using donation-based subsidies, the Conservatives would get roughly 50% of the federal money, whereas they only actually accounted for 38% of the vote. So one of the things that the per-subsidy vote allows for is that the proportion of the country that actually supports a party gets a portion of money to continue their democratic process. A lot of issues come up when you do with this whole campaign fundraising thing. I mean, one of the things when we look south of the border, right, is they have this big thing about $1, one vote. They've had a bunch of Supreme Court rulings that have stated that there's unlimited amount of funding to be given by parties. They can unlimited amount to support depending on how it's done. And it's just in order for a democratic process, I think, and this is my opinion, to be truly free of any undue influence, that this government financing is actually quite a good and positive thing. It's something that's done in a number of countries. Most countries actually have very limited donations, at least most democratic parties have limited donations. So above and beyond the idea that, you know, there's undue influence on the elected official, there's also the idea that the amount of time that goes into campaigning. In the United States, most politicians state that they spend more than 50% of their time fundraising instead of doing what they're supposed to do, actually running the country, finding out what people want. And then, of course, on the other side, everyone says, well, yes, but if you limit party donations or if you limit the way this is, that's somehow restricting free speech, which has its issues, but I don't know. I think on this one here that the idea of abolishing the per-vote subsidy just doesn't ring true in somehow supporting the democratic process, which is kind of what the proposers of it are doing.
Okay. So then the question, I guess, is how does allowing sort of large-scale donations to political parties influence free speech?
Well, you sit there and you I'm a large corporation or a large individual, and I say, hey, Ethan, I hear you're running for office, right? And I know it's hard out there, so I'm gonna write you a check for $1 million or something, right? Or I will offer you to advertise for you. And the United States, one of the ways they get around direct campaign donations is they will pay for an ad not sponsored by the party, but sponsored by a third party. Mm-hmm. And of course, so you get all this media exposure, and then you say, well, you know, thanks for the donation. Now, I know you would like me to support your big issue, be it atheist bus, because I know it's a big issue you have in your mind. But, you know, of course, you know, I don't think it's good for my community, so I'm going to vote against it. And you go, well, okay, you can do that, but I think next time I'm going to give my financial support to Bob over here, who will know how to play ball, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Mm-hmm. And in that way, the money just sort of gives certain people who have more money undue influence on the system. And I might point out that, I mean, we're not at the point yet of abolishing private contributions. I think we should. I think we should go to a complete system of a federally supported campaigning to minimize at least this sort of backhand, backdoor influence peddling. But that being said, at least we have a certain amount of flex money in the system to allow parties to organize and to push for issues that are important to their constituency between elections. I mean, this amounts to what I think it's about $2 million for the Green Party each year. It amounts to, I think, $10 million for the Conservatives. Not that I think they need it, but I mean, still, this is a substantial money that goes to campaigns, that goes to parties to do the things between elections to get organized.
Right. And, I mean, the other important issue is that the Canadian and American systems are quite different. The American systems, they know when their elections are coming up, whereas the Canadian system, we, generally speaking, don't know too much. I mean, there could be an election if the government falls. I mean, suppose this election produces similar results. We don't know for sure when the next election will be after it.
Right.
It could be 4 weeks away.
True.
It could be 8 months away, right?
Actually, I think it's 6 weeks. May 2nd? No, it's 4-8. Yeah, okay. In an odd sort of way, I think in a way that makes it harder for Canadian politicians, because although we have a smaller market and the media aspect of it has not become quite as big as it is in the States. I mean, from what I understand, Obama in his next campaign is going to have to raise over $1 billion to mount an effective campaign. I mean, that's $1 billion, right? I mean, that's an atrocious amount of money. Essentially wasted, to put it in a bad way, on campaign advertising. I mean, the Americans are complaining about their budget deficit. Could you imagine how good that would have been to take that money and put it towards their land? But in Canada, because we don't have as set deadlines, then in a way you kind of have to always be fundraising, because you never quite know when there's going to be an election. You got to kind of always have your hand in the till just in case, where at least in the American system you have a month or 6 months where you don't have to worry about it. Because, I mean, we'll say a year, because the campaign systems work on 2 or 4 year systems. But yes, it's not a good thing.
I see. Well, hopefully a solution will present itself, and if not, then political skepticism will have to do.
Well, and I really, really would like to hear what our listeners have to say about this. As I say, I have my obviously own biases on this, but you must have your own opinions and your own insight into how this works. And maybe I'm not approaching this in a truly good skeptic manner, and we'd like to hear from you. So please send us your email on this particular issue or any other issue you'd like us to do sort of a reality check into to radio.freethinker@gmail.com, and we'd get on top of that.
Absolutely. And speaking of, you know, getting tips, recently we got a tip from Ophelia Benson, who is the author of the Butterflies and Wheels popular blog. She was actually recently in Vancouver a little while ago, gave a talk on Does God Hate Women, of all things. Mm-hmm. Anyway, she pointed me in the direction of this new course that's being taught at UBC. Well, actually, I think it's a workshop. It's within the Faculty of Education. And I don't know, it's so strange, you know. Let me tell you a little bit about this course. This is from its website. The Theory Workshop is a monthly series that aims to support master's and PhD level students and their efforts to apply theory to research and conceptual theoretical endeavors. Presenters will show students how they have applied a theoretical framework or set of theoretical presuppositions to a particular problem, issue, question of interest to them. So that's, you know, mildly reasonable, I guess.
So what do you... listeners, when we go on with this, you're going to understand why I'm going to try and do this. So, Ethan, having read that bit, what do you think she's trying to say in more layman's terms?
From my point of view, I think they're trying to set up a course teaching like methodological research, learning how to formulate a hypothesis and theory. But let's go on a little bit with this. I looked at what they have coming up in April, and here's a bit of a blurb on their April workshop. Most of us who draw from and aim to produce critical theory set out to make analytical interventions in the making of political transformations. This is, after all, what sets critical theory apart from mainstream theory. In addition, in this workshop, we will explore and debate the political dimensions of the so-called effective turn, quotation marks, in the humanities in the past decade. In particular, we will examine Spinoza's concept of effect, quotation marks, together with that of resonance, quotation marks, which a number of authors, including myself, are beginning to explore to understand the bodily, spatial, temporal, and affective forces that are currently transforming a central geopolitical node of global imperial power.
Ethan.
Yes.
I will ask you again. What does that mean in layman's terms?
I don't know. I read this like four times trying to figure out what they're talking about. They have some sort of science-y sounding words in there, like, I don't know, turn and beginning. And they also say Spinoza, so maybe they mean philosophy. I'm not sure what resonance means, though. I mean, you're the philosopher. What does that mean?
Well, the nearest that I can kind of figure this out, I'm stealing Ethan's notes. Sorry, Ethan. So they use the term spiritualist concept of effect. And from what I remember and what I understand, Spinoza was sort of a stoic with this regard, is that we don't have the freedom to say no to something, but we do have the freedom to accept yes. So it's not so much that we can change the way reality is, but we can change how we react to that reality. And I think resonance in this particular case, because it's dealing with a lot of ideas of political transformation, you know, that's a big term that they're trying to do, and how they are trying to change the political landscape, which kind of goes against Spinoza, but we'll let that go for a minute. But resonance as in how this idea of learning to accept what is going on and having that reverberate, having that spread out through the political environment. So there's sort of like a mass movement for change. Well, how do you tap into that resonance, that mass vibration, and actually get change to happen or people to accept the change to happen, which is in an odd sort of way maybe already happened because everyone accepts that it should happen.
Mm. Yeah, it's a confusing
thank you,
theory.
Thank
you. I don't know. Maybe this is too postmodern for me. My hope, though, is that somebody at UBC has carefully vetted this material to make sure that it isn't bunk and that it's not going to poorly reflect the university's reputation as a place of learning and not home to postmodern BS. But I could be wrong.
BS? Bus yeah. Signs?
Sure.
Okay.
let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker. We'll be back with more after this.
The Georgia Strait, CITR 101.9 FM, Boutique Empire, and the Biltmore Cabaret are proud to present the Sex with Strangers CD Release Party, Thursday, April 14th. Local legends Sex with Strangers want to celebrate their latest release, Frontier Justice, with you. Yes, you. Joining in the party will be Run with the Herd and Joyce Collingwood, plus the world premiere of The Controlling Boyfriends and DJ sets by Guilty About Girls. How, oh how can I be a part of this, you're wondering? Well, advance tickets are available at Zulu, Red Cat, Neptune, and online at ticketweb.ca. Doors at 8, show at 9. Don't miss the Sex with Strangers CD release party, Thursday, April 14th at the Biltmore Cabaret.
Yeah, the state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now, hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting, like, more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a crowd. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver, CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
We're back on Radio Freethinker, so we want to quickly go over radiation.
Everyone, radiation in North America. Oh, no. Sorry, I'm just channeling what I've been hearing on the news about this radiation hysteria that's been hitting North America. Okay, it's not quite a hysteria yet. As you know, we've talked a bit about nuclear power and the incident at the reactors in Japan. This will probably be the last you'll hear from us for a while. However, I have been hearing a few things that I think should be set straight regarding radioactive fallout. First things first. It is a scientific consensus that there is no safe level of radiation, that radiation should always be treated as sort of a toxin regardless of its dose. And I don't want to sound like some pundits out there, notably the insane Ann Coulter, who was recently claiming in a homeopathic way that small doses of radiation are actually good for us. If I use the word safe, what I mean is safe relative to natural exposure. With regards to exposure, there are really sort of four main zones of exposure we should be aware of. First, there are those workers at the plant who have been exposed, and I have little doubt, to an extreme and life-altering amount of radiation. For their efforts, especially those whose efforts may be sacrificial in nature, to limit the magnitude of this disaster, we should give thanks. You know, thanks. You know, they did a heroic thing, and I'm sure a number of them will die from this event. There are those in the immediate area. The Japanese government instituted roughly a 20-kilometer evacuation zone. The UN recommended 40 kilometers. The Americans were saying 80 kilometers. Anyhow, those people are the ones who are most likely to be exposed to large dose of low-level radioactive particles, most notably iodine-131. Now, iodine-131 is only really dangerous if it builds up in the human body, notably the thyroid, where it gets absorbed. This was a big issue in Chernobyl for two big reasons. One, the local population had a low iodine diet. There just wasn't much iodine in their diet. And because of the actual Chernobyl explosion, there wasn't any time to do any precautionary measures. What kind of precautionary measures? When the Japanese accident happened, there was a rapid deployment of iodine pills to the local and I think even national populations. This combined with the Japanese diet of seaweed and that, which has a very high iodine content, means essentially there was no room in the thyroid left for iodine to build up. They kind of had stuffed up all the holes so that when the radioactive iodine did enter their system, it would be flushed out and would not be absorbed into their system. Now, of course, there's also the people of Japan itself. Although not likely to be directly exposed to radioactive particles in the same way that local populations would, there are, of course, elevated risks of what I would term secondary exposure due to contaminated food, people, and equipment. One of these sources, of course, of secondary exposure is the large amount of radioactive water runoff from the efforts of cooling off the reactors itself. In fact, this has been the big hot story of late about how thousands and thousands of liters of radioactive water is going into the ocean and increasing the amount of radioactivity in there. Now, the big thing with this is we have to remember the half-life of radioactive iodine. Now, half-life means how long does it take for half of the element to decay into less harmful components in this particular case. Now, the half-life of radioactive iodine is roughly a week, 8 days. So this means that it will decay relatively quickly and be removed from the environment. Also, most of the amounts where this high radioactivity has been occurring has been right around the plant itself. And as soon as you go about several kilometers offshore from the plant, it reduces back down to zero. Now, of course, in the one that we're all worried about here, because, well, we're North Americans, and we're used to worrying only about North America, is, of course, North America. Now, there have been a lot of reports that state that there have been elevated levels of radioactivity reported in here. Notably, UBC and SFU science departments have been making these measurements. Now, there have also been mixed reports of plutonium being found on the ground near the plants. Sounds scary. However, this detection is not so much the measure of the high concentration of pollutants, rather than the increased sensitivity of the detectors that we now currently use. There have been amounts of iodine-131 found, but not much. But they've been much below the natural amount of radiation we would normally be getting from cosmic radiation or terrestrial decay, i.e. radiation we get from the Earth from natural components decaying. Some reports mention radioactive milk and vegetables. Again, true to a point. The vegetables are largely those that have been grown in the local area around the reactor. But, of course, green plants will absorb this iodine. Other animals, like cows and that, will pick it up. And, of course, when they produce milk, you will get this chain of iodine. Here again, the amount of contamination is extremely small, and that we only really know about it because, again, our testing equipment has improved dramatically over the years, and it's quite sensitive. For those of you, of course, who are truly paranoid, you can skip your milk and your salads for a couple of months. Again, the radioactivity will be decayed. And eat only French fries, maybe frozen pizza, and Coke. I'm sure that'll be much healthier for you. Now, there is the possibility of cesium-137, which can actually pose a noticeable health threat, again, mainly to the people local to the area. It has a health life of 30 years, so it's going to be hanging around for a while. However, most scientists say that it's far too early to say that there's been any notable contamination of the area, and that that's something we need to keep an eye on, but something to look forward, not forward to, but to look at in the future. Being skeptics, I'm not underplaying the risks involved here. I just don't want people to overplay them. Now, of course, there is the reports of plutonium. Most of these, of course, have been on-site at the reactor and are only trace amounts. Actually, I've heard some people say that this is actually what you would normally expect around a nuclear power plant, and it's part of its normal contamination you'd get there, you know, irrespective of whether they had a nuclear accident or not. However, plutonium is a very heavy element and not likely to travel far. So it will be an issue for cleaning up that particular site, but it doesn't seem to be an issue for any of us to worry about. Now, some people will point out that after the Chernobyl disaster, plutonium was detected in Sweden and Poland, which again, from what I understand, is true, but the Chernobyl accident was quite different. It was a complete active core meltdown. I mean, the thing was running full blast and essentially went boom, and that had a lot of explosive power behind it, which would throw up the particles high into the air. The reactor in Japan, most of its explosions occurred from minor hydrogen release, and the rest of it has just been basically steam that has been going off. And so there's nothing that's had the kinetic energy to blow plutonium into the high atmosphere, which is why, again, something to keep your eyes open for. I don't want to underplay the possible risk here, but so far nothing that has really made me go, oh my God, like you have heard from some sources. Sadly, a lot of the sources that I like to listen to, because the left tends to get rather agitated about anything that deals with big corporations and pollution.
Mm. Speaking of getting agitated, I'm sure that the world is well aware of the situation which has resulted in the deaths of 14, possibly more, UN workers in Afghanistan as a response to the burning of a Quran in Gainesville, Florida by Terry Jones. So the controversy began in July and early September when the pastor of a small Christian Dove World Outreach Center in Gainesville, Florida declared that he would burn 200 Qurans on the anniversary of the September 11 attacks. This convincingly, of course, ignited a media firestorm and the pastor, Terry Jones, became the center of it. The resulting attention gave rise to international outrage and pleas from world leaders to cancel the event. And in early September 2010, he did cancel the burning and pledged never to burn a Quran. Now, however, on March 20th, 2011, he presided over a mock trial of the Quran, and it was found guilty by a mock jury composed mainly of his church members, after which a Quran was burned. On April 1st, 2011, protesters in northern Afghanistan, the northern Afghanistan city of Marsha Sharif, angered at Jones's burning of a Quran, attacked the United Nations assistance mission, killing at least 12 people, including at least 7 UN workers. And that number is expected to go up. We're not quite sure how many were killed, and there was also riots, so people might have been killed during the riots as well. But for the lack of a definitive number, we're just going to go with 14, because that's what I heard on the news. Now, there was a chance that no one was going to have heard of this event, but then the president of Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai, publicly announced it on March 24th, to the population of Afghanistan, which ignited protests. Following that, there were two suicide bombers who were disguised as women, detonated themselves, and a third one who was gunned down during an attempted attack at a NATO base in the outskirts of Kabul. And then on April 1st, three angry mullahs urged worshippers to avenge the burning of a Quran, and thousands of protesters overran the compound of the United Nations, where the 12 people and more were killed. Now, one of the mullahs was quoted in the New York Times as saying, "We expressed our deep concerns about this act, and we were expecting the violence that we are witnessing now. Unless they try him, Jones, and give him the highest possible punishment, we will witness violence and protests, not only in Afghanistan, but in the entire world." The killing itself, which some were saying was perhaps done by infiltrated Taliban insurgents, really doesn't matter compared to the fact that innocent victims were killed because a book was burned. Many free speech advocates and secularists are viewing this strategy with added concern. Reacting to the burning of a book with murder appears to be a demonstration of profoundly misguided and warped sensibilities. However, many proponents of multiculturalism are suggesting that burning a Quran is a deliberate provocation, and the offense it causes to Muslims justifies the outrage. That's something of a debate. When we look at the facts, though, I think a few things do become clear. One is that Terry Jones is an idiot. The man is a bigoted fool. He has a checkered past of lies, deceit, and abusive behavior. He founded a charismatic Christian church known as the Christian Community of Cologne in 1981, and he received an honorary degree from an unaccredited theology school in 1983 and began using the title doctor until he was fined by a German administrative court. He was kicked out of his church in 2008 due to the climate of fear and control that he employed, which included elements of brainwashing and telling congregants to beat their children with rods. Jones assumed full-time duties at the Dove World in 2008 after leaving the German church. By September of 2010, Dove World was to have 50 members, with about 30 members reportedly attending services. So this guy's a small fry, right? He's a you know, little guy here. In 2010, he published a book called Islam is the Devil. And afterwards, Jones announced the Quran burning. The German Evangelical Alliance denounced his theological statements and called him, you know, craving for attention. So I think the idea here that anyone should be listening to Jones or grant him any attention is just profoundly ludicrous. This person is a quack and a lunatic. There really is no other way of putting it. To listen to this guy is like going to, like, you know, the Ku Klux Klan for a, you know, view of Egypt or something. You know, it's silly. Now, there's, I think, additional facts that have to be pointed out here. The president of Afghanistan, you know, called upon the U.S. to punish Jones for burning the Quran. But he did not denounce the violence, and nor have any of the mullahs who originally provoked it. So what we appear to have here is a foolish bigot exercising his freedom of expression and burning a book. People are so enraged by this act, they have murdered a bunch of innocent people. There's a lot of attempts right now to find blame for all this. And I think you could pull out a fair bit. I think you can blame Jones, for instance, for stirring up trouble. That's pretty clear. people like him have caused a rise in racist action, not only against Islam, but against any group. And he's not, people like him are not just found in the U.S., but they're found all over the world. Europe right now is full of people like Jones who are getting people worked up over the fear that Muslims are going to invade and impose Sharia law on everyone. He's a small fry, but he's not unlike a lot of people out there in the world right now who are trying to stir up serious trouble. I would place a bit of blame on the Afghan president for publicly announcing what a fringe idiot did to a Quran in a country with little or no control over its radical elements. And of course, I think a lot of blame goes on the mullahs for inciting violence and provoking a riot that killed innocent people. And of course, I think the majority of the blame goes on the people themselves who committed the murders. Now, there are some who are arguing that Jones is not at fault here at all. They would say that he's definitely a racist, that's for sure. But the issue is rather free speech becoming under threat. If someone speaks with hate, does it give others a right to act with violence? Now, we've mentioned in the past how many religious believers have been pushing for notions of religious criticism, satire or serious, to be viewed as a crime against humanity. Now, what would this imply? That a true believer must not, should not, have to tolerate someone making fun of their religion or having their belief system questioned. Now, what does this lead to? If we outlaw criticism of religion, are we also saying that violent reactions to criticism of religion is tolerated? Well, I mean, that's an interesting question. I quoted Sam Harris here because I thought he had some interesting things to say. Everyone knows what Sam Harris's views on this sort of thing is. To quote him, "The point is not, and will never be, that some free person spoke or wrote or illustrated in such a manner as to inflame the Muslim community. The point is only that the Muslim community is combustible in this way." And there is an uncanny irony here that many have noticed. The position of the Muslim community in the face of all provocation seems to be, Islam is a religion of peace, and if you say that it isn't, we will kill you. Of course, the truth is often more nuanced. But this is about as nuanced as it ever gets. Islam is a religion of peace, and if you say that it isn't, we peaceful Muslims cannot be held responsible for what our less peaceful brothers and sisters do. So, this leads to some interesting issues to consider. To what extent does free speech extend when compared to criticism of religion? To what extent can we place blame on someone, like Jones, for provoking hate compared to the people who act out the violence against innocent people? And of course, are we faced with a cultural roadblock when it comes to free speech and free expression when members of the Islamic community are willing to condemn the burning of a Quran with violence like the kind that we see in Afghanistan? And I suppose you can cross out Islam and write in any religion you want, and you can cross out the Quran and violence with, you know, any criticism you want, whether it's satire or whether it's South Park, and replace that with sort of the threat of violence, of persecution, of censorship. And that's the question that I pose today, and I think, you know, hopefully our listeners and readers of our blog will have an opinion on that. I know Don must have an opinion on that.
Oh, do I never have not an opinion on... Yeah, I have an opinion on this one.
Okay.
In some ways, I think maybe you've misread this one. Okay. I kind of mentioned before that I think, in theory, a lot of things you say in principle were quite accurate and quite good. Yes, Reverend Jones, if I can use that term... Is a douche. He was exercising his free speech, he was performing an act of blasphemy. Maybe he should have waited for blasphemy to do this. But I think, as you're kind of pointing out, that one of the reasons why we as an atheist community and even as a skeptic community should distance ourselves as far as we can from his particular thing is he wasn't doing it in a skeptical way. He wasn't doing it to promote atheists. He was doing it to incite local anxiety issues, trying to gain a political base locally for his own particular issues. And that's an important thing. I'm going to mention politics again on this a little later. But that's that's what we should. So he does get some blame. Another big issue is, why is the media still covering this guy? I mean, why did he even get onto the news circuit to begin with? I mean, as you point out, he's a small little guy in the middle of nowhere, and the fact that he even, Karzai even got to hear of him strikes me as stunning. And I think that's where a lot of the sort of blame, in the sense that we've been talking, goes with, is there are a lot of people who are doing very bad things, saying a lot of very evil words, however you define that, but people ignore them because they should be ignored,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, definitely.
But, and of course, religious intolerance is an important issue to go in here. But I think it's very interesting that this happened in Afghanistan, because if you've been following the news, the big country with blasphemy has been actually Pakistan lately, where we've had a few assassinations over their blasphemy, and they've been killing locals. Yet, so why does Afghanistan suddenly come up there? Well, it's also important that it's UN workers. Afghanistan, as we know, is sort of an occupied country by the West. And the people internally are attempting to find some hook that they can motivate their own local people to fight against the oppressor, however they see him. And not necessarily because they want to overthrow the oppressor, but political animals like power. And we saw that big thing here locally with, well, not locally per se, but in Quebec. The French-speaking people in Quebec for generations have been oppressed by the English. And you had a number of French intellectuals who say, listen, we should try and rectify this and become equal. You had a number of minor people in that movement who said, listen, this is an opportunity for me to become a big wheel, and I'm going to take this genuine legitimacy and I'm going to push it into separatism, into all sorts of things. We had the FLQ crisis here in Canada, right? Mm-hmm. Where they took legitimate issues and they picked a wedge issue and they used it for their own political gain. I think the mullahs who are promoting this, although they profess otherwise, were doing it not because they were so much offended by it. I mean, they probably were offended, but they saw this as a great opportunity to attack and promote their own particular place in the society. Karzai himself has been under growing criticism from locals because they see him as in bed with the Americans, as a puppet of the Americans, and he's desperately trying to maintain his own power by mollifying the Taliban as they become more important in the country, and the quote-unquote warlords that actually control most of the country. Another thing that was really interesting about this, and I'm surprised it wasn't picked up much more, and there might be other reasons for this, but it was UN workers. And another interesting aspect that's come out in Afghanistan is that the Taliban quite often targets humanitarian aid, not so much because it's blasphemy or if it's against Islam, but if there's an alternative to me helping you, then you don't need me anymore. So if the UN workers are in there and they're providing education, they're providing food, then the local power base, be it Taliban, be it warlord, whatever, are no longer have this this blackmail ability that if you don't do what I do, you're not going to get fed this day, because they can always go to them. And I think that was one of the reasons why it was focused on this UN mission. It was also noticeable that the particular city that this all happened was a notably peaceful city relative for Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. So again, I think, although all the issues that you have mentioned about Terry Jones being a douche, about how we shouldn't feel stifled because something may be seen as religiously blasphemous, I agree with all of that. But I think in this particular instance, this is a horrible case of where a religious / atheist issue quickly gets hijacked for political means, and not so much in North America. Actually, I've been quite amazed at how many people haven't actually said, oh, we should nuke them to the Stone Age, right? But in Afghanistan, maybe it's nice to see that Americans and Canadians aren't the only ones who get on this religious bandwagon for ulterior motives, that it's happening there as well.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I've noticed before that Sam Harris seems to sort of take a position, and not just Sam Harris, other atheists as well, take the position that sort of there's something about Islam itself that makes this sort of thing happen. Whereas I think your sort of position that it's a lot more related to sort of politics and power and influence that allows this to happen. Like, I could see if you sort of flip things around and turned it into a Christian state, provoking crusades and whatnot, I'm sure you would get very similar reactions as if you have sort of this climate of warlords and terrorists vying for the sort of, you know, control of the people.
Well, you know, and another interesting thing that relates to this, and I think reinforces this kind of message, is the idea that where was the other really big thing that Muslims were burning and trying to stop free speech? Well, it was in Europe after the Danish cartoons, which was the inspiration for Blasphemy Day. And again, we shouldn't feel intimidated. But we can't forget that one of the big issues that's going on in Europe, especially with the minority communities, is they are an oppressed people there. They are treated as second-class citizens, that you are not one of us. They are ghettoized. And people who are attempting to make political gains will take genuine concerns, wrap them up in motivational type language, as in, oh, they're attacking the Quran, oh, they're trampling on God himself, and use that to incite violence and power for their own personal needs. Like I say, it's one of the things that stuns me is, why hasn't there been a riot in Pakistan? Egypt's been pretty quiet lately. I haven't heard anything in any of the other hot spots where this happens to, you know, where you get this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So again, Sam Harris's critique in general, I think, is true. Because, I mean, what's one of the Christian things? Turn the other cheek, you know, forgive thy neighbor, be very, you know, nice. I love, actually, how Terry Jones lied without lying, because he swore that he would not burn a Koran. And from what I understand, he wasn't actually the person to put the Koran in the fire. It was another one of his cohorts at mm-hmm. at the thing.
Right. Well, a really good conversation, I think. I'd be happy to hear our listeners' take on it. Remember to email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com. And, of course, visit us at our website, www.radiofreethinker.com, as well. We're pretty much out of time here on the show, so let's go to our skeptical highlights. Lots coming up, but I'll point out two that I think are worthy of note. The Breakfast of Champions, which is the UBC Freethinkers' monthly breakfast, and that's on Sunday, April 10th at 10:30 a.m. at the King's Head Pub in Kitsilano. Always lots of fun, so come out for that. And then later on in May, there's the Imagine No Religion Conference, which is happening in Kamloops, B.C. on May 7th. That's an all-day conference featuring an impressive lineup of speakers like P.Z. Myers, Jen McCrae, Krista Carlo, and Brian Dalton. And it's hosted by the Kamloops Center for Rational Thought and CFI Okanagan. So it's a good time to go up there. And with all the atheist bus ads floating around, it's sure to be a fun environment. So come on up for that.
Do you think there's going to be an atheist or skeptic bus group going up there, maybe?
Well, you know, I know there's a number of Vancouver skeptics who are looking to carpool up there. So keep your ear to the ground or wherever you put your ears, and I'm sure you'll find a bus or a ride or something.
I have one skeptic highlight. This is a talk entitled, Will the Revolutions Be Televised? Journalist and author Hadina Dimitars, sorry I butchered your name, examines regional unrest and the legacy of bombing in the name of peace and democracy in Iraq and Libya. This is essentially an ongoing thing, but we were talking about the no-fly zones. She was in Iraq before and after the no-fly zone there. This is being done at the UBC Graduate School of Journalism, April 6th, 12:30 to 1:30.
Alrighty then. Well, thanks for listening to Radio Freethinker today. This is Ethan, your freethinking historian, saying so long, folks.
And this is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
Bye-bye.